This is Mae Warren. Today is the 19th of July, 1999. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm with Louise Cavagnaro. Is that how you pronounce
Cavagnaro.
It? Cavagnaro. Cavagnaro. And I'm just so pleased to be here because we met several months ago, and everybody down at the Chesney Archive says that you know everything about everybody everything.
I don't really, but...
Well, let's start by having you give me a brief background about yourself before you came to Hopkins, because I know you had an interesting life there, but let's keep it succinct, but tell me about who you were before you came to Hopkins.
Well, I guess the thing is, I went to college first and majored in science, and then in my last year, I was going to have to take 5 years to do my college work because I was working part-time. And so I quit in the middle of my fifth year and went into nursing. While I was in nursing, the war started. As soon as I finished nursing, I went in the Army Nurse Corps, and within 5 months, I was in Europe, where I stayed until the end of the war, and in fact, came back to the United States in October, and went to the University of Washington to graduate school in nursing, well, actually in education with a minor in nursing. But while I was there, the Army was pressuring to ask me to come back on active duty for 18 months. So I decided to do that because my brother was still in college. My father was dead, of course. And so anyway, I went back in the Army and volunteered for Japan. I was sent to Japan. And while I was there, I did a favor for somebody and met the people with the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. So then they talked me into, when I got out of the Army, going to work with them. And they were looking for a director of nursing. So when they waited about 8 months for me to get out of the Army. And then I came back to the United States, got out of the military, and flew back to Japan, and was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki then until 1951, when I left to come back to the States. Now, while I was at Hiroshima, while I was director of nursing, things were quite different, and so I did everything. I did everything from finding a laundry in town to wash the uniforms to going to the military and buying sheets to have uniforms made for the nurses. I worked with the architects to design the new facility and just kept doing all sorts of things, so that the doctors at that said, when you go back to the States, why don't you change and major in hospital administration? One of the doctors was from New York, and he thought that would be the ideal. So I applied for New York, for Columbia University in the hospital administration, and they kept sending me back letters suggesting that I apply at the University of California in Berkeley, not rejecting me, but not accepting me. So when one of the doctors was there from the National Academy, he said, Dr. Davidson, in fact, who was the president of Duke University at that time, and he said, Cavi, I understand that you want to go into hospital administration. And he said, we'll take you at Duke. And I said, well, I thought it would be better if I went to Columbia, being a female. And the program at Duke was fairly new and getting started. And he said, that's right. And when he heard that the kind of response I was getting, when he got back to the States, he called Washington, and Dr. Owen then called Columbia University. And they said they only took one woman a year, and they had already accepted that one woman. But after the Academy talked to him, they decided to accept another one that year. So I was accepted. Thank goodness I worked for the National Academy of Science, and the people really were supportive. So then while I was at Columbia, the head of the program became quite ill early on. He had a hot gallbladder. And so I specialed him for about 4 or 5 nights because he was really sick. And I wouldn't take any money for that, but I couldn't do it any longer than that. Anyway, he did very well. And so when I applied, we had to do a residency, a one-year residency. And every place I went to interview, they said, well, the job was filled. But they would call him back and say, we're not going to take a woman, don't send a woman. But so having been so nice to him when he was ill, he called me into the office one day and he said, I feel you ought to know this. And he told me, of course, he told me about what the Academy had done to help me. And he said, I have a letter here from the doctor at the University of Virginia who said he will take a resident. He was in the program here when he came back in World War II. So he said, I'm not going to tell anybody else about it until you have a chance to apply. So I wrote to him and Dr. Ackert, and I said, there's no point in my bothering you further if you aren't interested in having a woman on staff. And he wrote back and told me he thought they were here to stay. So I went down for an interview. I was going to Washington to visit friends, and I went on to Charlottesville. And I was with him about an hour when he offered me the job. But he said, I'm not going to make you take it right now. He said, I want you to have a fair chance to look at us. It was a lot different. At that time, all the black patients were in the basement. So he wanted to know if I'd be able to handle the situation. And I said, yes, you know, I thought I could. So I went to UVA. And while I was at UVA, of course, Dr. Ackert, being from Hopkins, wrote to Dr. Nelson at Hopkins about me. And I had been offered a job at the new clinical center at NIH, which was thanks to the academy. But it hadn't opened yet. It was in the process of going to be opened. And I didn't really think I wanted to work for the government at that time. And I thought that going to a hospital like Hopkins would benefit me. And if I had a couple years there, then I could go back to the West Coast. And, you know, and with that background, I wouldn't get that problem of being a female all the time. But anyway, they told me they didn't have a job, but they'd be glad to talk to me. So I came up to Washington to visit friends, and then I came over for the day to Hopkins. And Dr. Nelson hired me the day I came just to talk to him. I kidded him at my retirement, saying I was the only administrator that paid her own way for a job interview. and he's still alive, Dr. Nelson is. He's down in Florida, Russell Nelson. So I thought I would be here a couple of years and go back to the West Coast, and I never went back. I didn't stay in the same job, obviously, but I went to work actually for Dr. Harry Chant, who's dead now. He was the associate director of the hospital. And of course, you realize how large the place is, but it was amazing. I guess it took me about 2 years to really find my way into all the places, and it wasn't as large as it is now. And to meet enough people that made the job really interesting. And so then I was offered three different times. I was offered good jobs other places, but decided to stay at Hopkins. And I worked, and as far as I was 19 years with the Department of Surgery. Actually, the day I arrived, Dr. Nelson just asked me, I was going to be an administrative assistant on professional services, and that's the way it was organized in those days. There were the administrative services and the professional services. We had radiology and laboratories and social work and all that sort of thing. But he asked me if I would be the administrator in the operating room. That the nurse in charge up there was an old timer, and she and Dr. Blaylock were having a little difference of opinion on some things, and he thought maybe I could get them together. So from the day I arrived, I was the administrator in the operating rooms and worked with Dr. Blaylock. And then later on, of course, I went part-time with the university. In 1964, I went part-time with the university as the administrator in surgery, the Department of Surgery, and then part-time with the hospital as the administrator in surgery. And so they split my salary at that time. And I stayed with that split position from 1964 till 1972, when I went back full-time with the hospital as the vice president for administrative services. Well, I used to tell people I was the G-man. Whenever Dr. Nelson Heisel would call the office, by this time Nelson had retired, my secretary would say, guess who's on the phone? And she said, what are we going to get next? He would call me and say, Cavi, he'd say, who's in charge of whatever it was, the problem that had come up? And I said, well, I guess there really is nobody. He said, well, would you see that something gets done about it? And that's why he was telling everybody I was the G-man. But it made life more interesting, the garbage man to pick up. And during one of the strikes, of course, I really was a garbage man. But I think that I got to know so many people in the hospital that it made my job interesting. And when I say the hospital, not just in the hospital itself, but the university, think of the medical school and the hospital, because there were, I don't know as many people like in hygiene as I knew in the medical school.
You've touched on so many different things already. But let's talk about this distinction you're making now between the hospital and the university.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about that.
Well, of course, the from the beginning, if you look into the old records, you know, the committee has changed its name several times, but the and there's always been this, quote, joint business, whether it was the Joint Administrative Committee or the whatever you wanted to call it, and I can't remember the name is what it's called today. But while they're two separate corporations, and have been from the beginning, they've always worked very closely together. And I think it's essential, you know, that the two do that, because they complement each other so that, and I'm sure that at times, I know that at times there have been friction between individuals, but I would say that, you know, the two institutions have got along remarkably well. When you think of the kind of people who are ahead of things, are people with some pride and ego, and you don't get peons to be into those positions. So I'm sure that there have been differences of opinion among them as to sometimes what's best for the both institutions. But I think they get along remarkably well for their size, and but one can't get along without the other, you know, as far as I see it, you know. And I feel that way today, too, that, and of course, now we have the new organization, you know, that they've, that Miller is now head of, Dr. Miller. Again, someone was telling me yesterday, well, Dr. Miller's head of the hospital. I said, no, he isn't. Dr. Peterson is the president of the hospital. And Dr. Miller is the head of the, what's it called, the Johns Hopkins medical. I have to think about that one, but I can't remember what it's called today. But it's the two organizations that's they're not incorporated into one organization, that but closely working together. And I see medicine is changing. If you realize what's happened in the last 50 years, well, just I came in 53, remember, and so it's almost 50 years. And I, when people tell me, oh, everything changes, I said, well, it has to change. Look what's happened. When I came, there was no such thing as bypassing the heart. There was no such thing as transplanting organs. We didn't have dialysis even when we started. So all these changes are going to bring changes. And we're living longer because all the new medicines that are out, all the new procedures are out, people are living longer, so there's a whole new thing for the hospital to do and the university. And I was very interested in reading the article in the medical, Johns Hopkins Medical News magazine, about the gerontology, the approach that they're doing in gerontology, because whether anybody likes it or not, people are living longer. All the inventions, all the different medicines, everything else, you know, it's changing the practice of medicine. And so people are just going to have to accept the fact. Now, I think it's hard for people to make major changes. And I think that HMOs, you know, and of course Hopkins is into that now. The HMOs are things that sort of turn people off. I know a lot of people like me, I feel like I want to pick my doctor. I don't want an HMO to tell me who I'm going to see. My throat today has really been giving me trouble. I don't know. Since I've been at Hopkins, did you look at the list of buildings that I put together? How many buildings have been there?
Not yet, but let me finish with one thing first.
Okay.
When you talk about the university,
mm-hmm.
in East Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
the presence. Tell me what you mean by that. I understand the hospital. Tell me what the university is when you're talking about the university.
Well, as I said, I've known some people in the School of Hygiene and worked with some of them particularly in the past on committees. But my closest relationships have been with the medical school and now with the School of Nursing. The new School of Nursing, when they decided to look into having a university School of Nursing, Dr. Heisel asked me if I would work with Dr. Gray, who was was brought up from Texas to do a survey and an evaluation as to the practicality of establishing a School of Nursing. So I worked with Carol before the decision was made to really have one. And I saw that he said, well, you see that she meets the important people on the medical staff, which I did. I saw that she met those people, some of whom are now dead, because it was important that she get a full view. And after all, the medical staff is very much a part of the care of patients and in the education of nurses.
Who's Carol?
Carol Gray was the first, she became the first dean of the School of Nursing. She was before Sue Donaldson, okay? Mm-hmm. But she originally came here to do a review. She was brought up by the university and the hospital to to evaluate the situation and whether or not it was practical and possible to set up a university School of Nursing. See, the old Hopkins School of Nursing was a hospital unit, and that had closed in, I think it was 1972, that they decided to close the school. I forget when the last class graduated. Then they set up another nursing program, but they set it up in the School of Allied Health Sciences, which didn't last very long. And I was disenchanted with that approach. I didn't think that if they wanted to do a university nursing school, I felt it should be a separate school, just as the medical school was. And the School of Allied Health Sciences, gosh, I don't know how many years it survived, 5, 6, 7, not too many.
I've never even heard of it.
You've never heard of it? Oh, no. Well, it's very much a part of the history of in there, yeah. And there is information in the archives on it. And there are, I was trying to think who's around that would have been associated with that. There's still a few people around that could be of assistance to you. Yeah, yeah. It never did go over well. And I don't know whether it was because of the individuals. They didn't help the matter, probably. However, the School of Nursing was never going to be a success under that organization. There are too many separate university schools of nursing, and we're competing with them for the kind of people we want. If Hopkins is going to have a school, it had to be the best, you know. It's now ranked number 6 in the United States in the schools, along with my old school of nursing, the Oregon Health Science University. So that I think that now the way it's set up, I think, is important. Yeah. I was very pleased when they decided to establish a university school of nursing. And I've always said anything I could do to help them, I'd be glad to do. And I have helped them with a lot of things, recovering some of the things that were put into storage and around from the old School of Nursing. And then the Nurses Alumni Association, their records were in bad shape. They were just a mishmash, really. It would not be useful. And so I did a preliminary. I worked with them, and we brought them over at the archives, and I did a preliminary sort to get out the garbage so that you could find something in there. And recently, when somebody was doing a historical project, it made it a lot easier for them to, because I had separated out certain things to make it easier, not just to open a box. At least you can open a box now and everything is into folders that are labeled and there's a list of what's in there. It needs to be done in more finite way, but I don't have 2 days a week in the archives. I don't have enough time to do that. But I'm hoping that they're now going to employ someone to do it. I've been working with them and pointing out the necessity of having an archivist come in and really bring up to date, because there's some wonderful history stuff in there if you want to go into the history of nursing education in the United States. And remember, it was one of the early schools. And
At Hopkins.
Not just at Hopkins, one of the early schools in the United States. Mm-hmm. When the Hopkins School opened in 1889, when the hospital, well, that fall after the hospital opened, the School of Medicine didn't open until 1893.
That's pretty impressive, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, oh yeah. And when you realize, and of course, Columbia took one of their good graduates and had her start the first university school of nursing at Columbia. So there have been really quite an interesting group of people. I think Hopkins, the people that have been at Hopkins have, I think they were, when they came, and the first people that came, whether it was Osler or Halstead or Welsh, it was always, we're going to be the best, you know, and they were, and that's what Hopkins, Johns Hopkins wanted, was it would be a great place. And so it has attracted that kind of people, I think.
You've mentioned a couple of people mm-hmm. who fall into that category. Tell me about Dr. Blaylock.
Dr. Blaylock, I guess I was in charge of the operating rooms administratively for almost 2 years before I even met him. Yeah.
How could that be?
I don't know, but you can say, well, maybe it was partly my fault that I didn't pressure somebody to introduce me. But I figured the time would come, and I don't really remember the first time that I met with him and what the problem was. But after I did get to know him, he was very nice to me. And, you know, when there was a problem, I could call and get an appointment. And then sometimes his secretary would call me, and he was so polite, and she'd say, Miss Cavanero, she said, Dr. Blaylock would like to meet with you. Do you think you could arrange to meet with him today by any chance? About 12 o'clock or 11 o'clock or something like that, you know. And I'd say, oh, sure, you know, because I could always manage to do it unless I wasn't there. And then when I'd come down to his office, he always stood. He would be working at his desk. The minute I walked into the room, he would stand, and he would remain standing until I was seated. And when he was finished with me or I was finished with him, depending on the purpose of the meeting, he always walked to the door for my exit. He was a real gentleman, you know. And the nurse with whom he was having, there was some friction. When I took over administratively, things got settled. And in fact, when she retired, I think Elizabeth retired in 59, so it would have been about 6 years later. He asked me to arrange her farewell party, and he said that the department wanted to do something for her, wanted to give her something, and I suggested that they buy her a desk, that I had been in her apartment, and I knew what she really needed. And so he told me to pick it out, and you know, which I did. We still had a wonderful furniture store here in town. I went down Gompreck and Benish, and they gave me a discount since the department was buying it. And they spent about $700 for that desk, though. It was a beautiful, you know, high boy type desk. And I arranged the reception and arranged to invite Dr. Halstead's secretary was still alive. She was living over at Church Home, and I saw that she was brought up, because Miss Sherwood had been with her, of course, and so it was an interesting experience.
I'm trying to remember the Blue Baby. It all happened.
The Blue Baby was done in the 40s before I came.
Yes,
but I did get to know Vivian Thomas very well.
No, I don't. Tell me.
Vivian Thomas was the black man who was given the honorary doctorate by the university. He only had a year of college. He came up from Vanderbilt with Dr. Blaylock. He'd been his technician down there. And he's the one that did a lot of the work in the laboratory, you know, developing the procedures and some of the instruments and things that were used in the Blue Baby. There's a book. Did you see his book that was written?
I haven't looked. I've been concentrating on Homewood since I got here, and I'm headed down to East Baltimore soon. So
yeah.
you're my intro.
The intro. Okay.
Assume I know nothing. Tell me everything.
Well, Vivian, his portrait, the old portrait of him hangs in the lobby, the Blaylock lobby. And In fact, I raised where it would be hung because I was still with the department when that was done. And I arranged that it be hung in that lobby. I thought it should be near in a place where it related because of his relationship with Dr. Blaylock, that it should be in the Blaylock lobby where Dr. Blaylock's portrait was too. And so it is there. He, his wife is still alive, and I keep in contact with her because there are a number of groups that want to do stories on Vivian, and if you, you'll have to take a look at his book, and you can see he what he says about me. I won't quote. You can read it out of the book.
So Vivian Thomas has written a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Ravitch helped edit it. Ravitch is, of course, dead now, but Vivian wrote a book. Oh yeah.
Are there pictures in it?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I'll have to take a look at that.
Let me just. Can I just?
Oh, let's look
okay.
at it later.
Okay.
Let's
fine.
Look at it later.
Okay.
So, will you explain for me what the Blue Baby operation was all about?
Well, the Blue Baby operation didn't entirely correct the situation in the heart. What it did was it helped to get more blood to the, and I'm not a physiologist, so you can read this in the book. And then later on, but it got people to survive. You see, the Blue Babies would be dead sometimes within days of delivery and sometime within a very short time or years. I don't know the longest period that any of them lived before the Blue Baby operation, but not a long time. And, of course, Helen Taussig had some of the ideas, but Blaylock and the surgeons really developed the procedure to do the correction. But actually, it wasn't a complete correction, as I said. It was a, I'm trying to get my memory to go back. I used to know a lot of this stuff a lot better, but trying to recall some of this stuff. I can't think right now what the defect is called. Blue Baby was just, of course, not the defect, the heart defect. And as I said, the operation did not completely correct everything, but it permitted them to live, yeah. And many of them have gone on. I saw in the paper one of them died in his 50s the other day. He was a musician, and it was in the New York Times. It was in one of the papers, New York Times, I think, that he had died. Yeah.
And it identified him as having been?
Been one of the Blue Babies, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So there were a lot of them, and Catherine Neal, she's in England right now because I think one of her sisters is ill, but she was an assistant to Dr. She came here as a cardiology fellow and then stayed on the faculty, and she's a retired professor of pediatrics. She works in the archives a couple days a week too, Catherine does, and she worked with, of course, Dr. Taussig all along, yeah. So she can tell you more about the Blue Baby. As far as Vivian's concerned, I remember, segregation was still very much in place when I came here. See, Brown versus the Board of Education decision didn't come until 1954, and that's when integration of the schools started, which made some changes. And of course, a lot of the changes then occurred, I think, after Martin Luther King's death. But the hospital had already started desegregation before Brown versus the Board of Education. And both Dr. Nelson and his predecessor, Dr. Crosby, what they did was a lot of painting in the hospital. And when they would paint bathrooms, they would take the signs colored in white off, and then the signs never went back. And when I took over the Marburg building, which was then what we called the Gold Coast, it was where most of the private patients were in Marburg, and the famous patients were all there in it. Right now, Marburg 3 is one floor that's very selective, but actually the whole building was at that time. And when I took over in 1955, I talked to Dr. Nelson about desegregating so that when we had respectable black people that wanted a private room, that they have an opportunity to have one. And he agreed with me, and the only way to do it was we didn't put out a memo. I used to go to the admitting office and check every day to see
what they had in the way of private patients wanting private rooms. And that's what we started desegregating that way. And if anybody complained, I had a few patients complain they didn't want black patients where they were. I always volunteered to make arrangements at the hospital of their choice and arrange for the ambulance transfer. And nobody ever took me up on it. A couple times we had patients complain about black people taking care of them. And as one of my southern patients told me, he said, well, they must be nouveau riche, because if they ever had anything and they're from the South, they would have had black people taking care of them all their life, practically. But it went very smoothly, and then desegregation went that way in the hospital. There was never any big proclamation and any change one day, and the units were almost all integrated by the time of Martin Luther King's death. And, of course, the School of Medicine did not integrate as far as admitting blacks until the 60s. I think it was around 1967. They took women from day one. Of course, women raised the money when men had been unable to do it, to start the medical school. But I think that... as far as the care of patients were concerned, the doctors, I don't really feel discriminated against a patient by their color. A lot of our black patients, of course, couldn't afford private facilities. But they were cared, the care that was given to them, I always felt that was as good, you know, there was no difference in the way it was done.
So if you weren't in a private room, you were in a ward?
Not necessarily. We had the wards, all the wards in Marburg, Oster and Halstead had all the wards. The wards weren't just a big ward. Every one of those units had two single rooms and at least one four-bedroom and there were slight variations between them, but they... And then the ward itself was divided up into, it was 16 beds in the ward, and there were four, then partitions, four. So they were not wards in a huge thing like this. Like in the old days, if you go back to the old pictures in 1889, that's the way the wards were. You know, they were wide open. And that's the way they were in Europe, too, in the old hospitals of Europe. I think that... in fact, I guess it was Halstead 3 that in 19, we took it and made it into an orthopedic unit. And then we eliminated all trace of the ward. The largest spaces were two bed units. Yeah. And of course now, if you look at the floors, there are a lot of two bed rooms that's semi-private. Mm-hmm.
That was a question I wanted to ask you, was how that evolution happened and why it happened of wards going away.
I think wards went away. First off, it's very difficult, you know, you can't mix men and women in those areas. And if the patients are up and around the way they are today. So they're not practical anymore. And not only that, but there, with insurance, as it came into being, more people, you know, had insurance to help pay their stay, which would pay for semi-private accommodations. And I think it was a series of things. It was, do you think that noise back there bothered?
No,
I think so.
All right.
Yeah. I think that insurance... and the flexibility, the wards were not flexible. And if you wanted to have patients, you better provide the type of facilities they wanted. And a patient with insurance was not going to go into a ward bed. So they went. And of course, the old Halstead buildings had to be like when I redid Halstead 3, that was in the 60s that we redid that. Yeah, it was before I went up to in 72. And we wanted, it was just to be for orthopedics. So it had some single rooms for sicker patients and then mostly two bedrooms. So it was, I think, and as I said, as these things got renovated, the wards went. But when we desegregated, for example, Marburg, we started first in there, the desegregation gave private rooms for black patients. But in the Thayer building, the old Thayer building, which has been torn down, which is the Octagon building, there were two rooms up there with two beds in each of them. And so one of them, I said, keep it for blacks, and one of them you can keep for whites. And so that there were some semi-private beds then for blacks. Now remember in those days, and of course even today, we have the women's clinic, which has, well, we don't have the women's clinic anymore per se. See, they're in the Nelson building. But the women's clinic had all OBGYN, which was different. You see?
Tell me what you mean.
Well, now what they did when they built the Nelson building, they thought in terms of making it possible to move laterally. So you didn't have to use the elevators to move patients from a unit to a unit. So if you go into the first floor of Halstead, the first floor of Osler, or the second floor, because they're on the first floor, no, because the first floor has other things. But the second floor of Halstead and the second floor of Osler, one used to be medicine, one used to be surgery. Now that's all OB. And the delivery rooms are on the second floor of the Nelson building, and they all connect through the Harvey Tower so that you can move from labor into the rooms without having to go up and down in elevators, okay? And then, I'm not sure which floors now are GYN, but GYN is over there too. The old women's clinic, as we knew it, was torn down and was replaced by the Meyer building. The Meyer building was originally for the neurosciences, neurology, neurosurgery. And if you go over there now, I understand that they not only have neurology and neurosurgery, but some otolaryngology is over there too. So I don't try to keep up with all that's there. But as you look at the list of buildings and see what's come and gone, there's five pages on the computer.
Let's talk about that. You've been throwing out lots of names of lots mm-hmm. of buildings. And of course, what jumps out at me is I recognize so many of these names mm-hmm. as being famous doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
Are all the buildings named for doctors at Hopkins?
No. The Carnegie, the dispensary, what we call it, the old timers call the dispensary building, the old Carnegie dispensary building, which is on Monument Street, is named for the Carnegie Foundation, which gave the money to build it, really. The Marburg building is named for the Marburg family, who were some of whom were trustees, and the family gave money toward building a wing onto the original. The buildings were called, didn't have names when they were built, the three buildings on Broadway. And what became the Marburg building was the C building, and it got, when they built a wing onto it to add more beds, then they renamed it the Marburg building, and actually that was for a family. The Halstead and Osler buildings got obvious for whom they're named. The Nelson Tower is named for Russ Nelson, the man who hired me. The Harvey Tower is named for Mac Harvey. The Heisel, Jayhawk, Johns Hopkins Outpatient Center is the Heisel building. And that was, he took Dr. Nelson's place as head of the hospital. What other buildings are, well, the, oh, the,
mentioned Thayer.
Meyer building is named for the first professor of psychiatry. And Thayer was named for a doctor, and that's, of course, gone. And then the across the street in the medical school, you see you have the Ross building, named for one of the former deans of the medical school. And you have the Turner building, one of the former deans of the medical school. You have the... let's see what else is over there. Well, the 8024 building, but there are several buildings without names on them. But if you look at the list, you can see, you know. And the list of buildings, is all the campus, the medical campus, not just the hospital, not just the medical school, not just the school of hygiene, because there are three distinct schools there. Well, actually, there's a fourth one, which is not a school, but the Welsh history, the history of medicine is a separate. Wilmer, by the way, was named for a doctor too. The medical library and the history of medicine, that is a separate entity in a way.
All right, I'm from another planet. Tell me about what is down there in East Baltimore. Describe this complex that's down there and how you've seen it change through the years.
Well, I think I've seen it. It was originally a 14-acre campus, was what it was supposed to start out to be, the hospital. And then the medical school had a few lots across the street. And what has happened since I arrived is that buildings have been torn down and replaced by new buildings in existing space, but additional space has been acquired. And the neighborhood was quite concerned at one time that Hopkins was pushing them out. And you can find that, where there was some bitterness on the part of the neighborhood. On the other hand, the neighborhood was a white neighborhood around the hospital when I came, and that changed. And so that it's hard to tell, you know, who did what. But if you go Broadway was the boundary on the, if Monument Street is on the north side, Broadway is on the east side. That was the east boundary as far as the buildings that Hopkins had. But buildings came up on that side. The first one, I guess, that really belonged to the hospital was Hampton House, was this nursing home, a nurse's home. And that was built in 1932, the first part of it, and then it got expanded. But then on that side of Broadway came where a church had been. The church is gone, and the big outpatient center is over there. Also over there on that side of Broadway is the big new oncology research center, which is not finished yet. And beyond that, behind those, some time ago, back in the 60s, they built a center of shops. There was a grocery store. Acme had a big market there, and there were different shops there, and some parking facility. Well, what's happened to all that is it's all no longer shops, no longer grocery stores, and it has become everything from different components of the Johns Hopkins institutions, some space being used by the university, some being used by the hospital. They were then, at the same time that they built that, they built housing for house staff. And now all the house staff housing is gone. That was all torn down. And there's a parking lot to the outpatient center back there where that used to be. And there's going to be a parking lot where another part of it used to be, which will be under construction. The Cooley Center is over there, which is a big recreation center, gymnasium and everything that was built, and a swimming pool, named for Denton Cooley, the heart surgeon in Texas, who trained under Al Blaylock, Chris at Hopkins.
Hold on, we need to turn the tape over.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's kind of dizzying to think. I remember the first time I ever came to visit somebody, and I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
There's just so much there.
That's right.
How do people keep it all straight?
Well, it's amazing, you know. Of course, there, as I said, I was there 2 years before before all this expansion, remember. The Blaylock building had been built when I arrived. And several buildings were torn down in order to build the Blaylock building. But the old buildings were still there, like the Thayer building and the old woman's clinic and so on. They were all still there.
Now, when you said the old buildings, how old were the old buildings? Were
these the original building was original.
You remember the original buildings?
Yeah.
Oh, describe them for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, the original buildings, the three on Broadway, parts, the administration building, the dome building, mm-hmm. that's the original building. Now, those three buildings form what's known as the National Historic Site, and you cannot change the exterior of those buildings. On the other hand, they've had to replace windows in my office was on the second floor of the administration building when I retired. That's where my office was. And when the helicopters used to land on the children's center, on the roof of the children's center, it would shake the windows. You know, sometime I thought, I wonder if one of them was going to fall out. They've had to replace the windows, even though it's a historic site. There was nothing else you could do, the wooden frames and everything, you know. And as those are going to deteriorate over a period of 100 years, I mean, you can only expect so much out of them. And remember, that place was under construction for about 10 years, too. Anyway, then on the side, which is now Wilmer, that was the female wards, the female pay ward, it was called in the old, female pay. It became the Wilmer building, and then they added onto it, and they added the Woods building onto it, and they added the other building that's been added onto it. But then on the other side, the male pay wards is now the Marburg building, but they added a wing onto that. And they added a third floor onto that. If you look at the pictures, you can see the changes. You might want to, in the archives, I put together a book where we've shown pictures of the buildings as, you know, you go by year. These are, when I say pictures, they're graphs and whatnot. And you can see the changes that occurred. And if we're trying to date a picture, my building list is very helpful, because in the building list I tell you when they added the third floor onto the Marburg building. So if you look at a picture and there's no third floor and the old shutters are on the second floor and whatnot, you know then it's before this got done. And I started that list when Dr. Harvey was doing the history, you know, for the centennial. And he and Dr. McCusick would call me and say, Cavi, when did such and such happen? And I'd have to check. So I thought the smart thing to do is now to just as I look up these things, make a list of them, you know, and which is what I did. And now we keep it up to date and it's on the computer.
Bless your heart.
I mean, you know.
Oh, that's so valuable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was impossible. And, you know, you had to dig. I would dig through some of the stuff that was in Dr. Chesney's history, the first three volumes that he wrote, or I would look. He's one of the former deans, you know. Or I would go into the trustee minutes when things were approved. And so it was a lot of work. And to just not preserve that, you know, which I did. And so we have a building list.
Oh, that's so valuable.
And then I did the paper. At the same time I was doing that, I realized that people were asking questions about desegregation and when things occurred. So I did a paper on desegregation. Yeah. And that, and you can have one of those. We can give you one at work. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. I certainly will.
Yeah, because I wanted to talk to people and put into their Dick Ross and Russ Nelson and them, you know, because some of this stuff is not written, and you have to talk to people who were there and who participated in the decisions. Some things, of course, are in writing. You know, they're. I think that. And what's happened is if you go on the back side of the hospital, on Wolf Street side, of course, the School of Public Health, you see, that didn't open until the 20s. And that was one building in the middle. Since then, they've added one, two, three wings onto it, and a fourth wing is going to be under construction real soon. There were a lot of houses back there. My boss lived back there. The president, well, when he was the director of the hospital, for example, he lived back there.
So what was the reaction when houses started being torn down?
Well, these were all houses that white people lived in. They weren't, there were no...
So?
Well,
still, what was
no,
the reaction?
They had already moved out.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Nelson moved, about the time I came, he moved out to Towson. And then actually lived down at 100 West University Parkway by the time he... when he retired.
Well, were the houses then empty?
No, no, on Wolf Street, people lived in them until they got torn down. And back there, they've built two houses for cancer patients' families that were contributed in different ways to the institution. They've built, and then the hospital for families of children who are in the hospital, and they pay for their hotel, quote, accommodation based upon their ability to pay. And if they can't pay, well, then and they're from out of state, you know, they're taken care of back there. Then back on Washington Street, went over, there were a lot of black people that lived back there, and a lot of them, but most of them didn't own the places. Again, there were absentee landlords, and the houses were not well kept. There were some houses that belonged to white employees of the hospital, and some of those places, I think, still, well, I know one of them still belongs, because she still, she doesn't work at the hospital anymore, but she's one of the nurses, and I'm not sure where she's working now, but her house, I know she still owns. One of the nurses died recently and left the house to the School of Nursing, so what's going to happen? Some of those places will probably eventually go. Yeah. So
was there a lot of resistance, though?
There have been a lot of ill feelings in the neighborhood about the expansion of the institution, you know. But, and as Lottie Cole, who's a black woman, who's a friend, personal friend, as Lottie said to me, you know, Dick Cav, she said, my dad used to tell me that he couldn't enter the front door of the hospital. And she said, I told him that was not true. But what people perceive and what's true can be quite different.
Tell me what you mean by that.
I mean, if somebody thinks they can't enter the front door. Now, remember, in the old days, most of the black patients were poor. They paid practically nothing, if anything at all, for their care. And the free care was all provided in the dispensary building, the Carnegie building on the Monument Street side. So if they came in there because they weren't feeling well and seen by a doctor, then the doctor decided they had to be admitted, then they were admitted from there. And that's why they didn't come in the front entrance of the hospital, because you didn't come in that way unless you had a private doctor. Didn't have anything to do with color. But, and of course, in the old days, that building, the administration building, a lot of the doctors lived on the second and third floors.
Really?
Oh, yeah. When I came, there were still doctors living on the third and fourth floors, yeah.
Living full time?
Oh, yeah.
There were apartments there?
Well, not apartments, but there were rooms. The house, you know, the fellows and residents lived up there. But in the beginning, Dr. Osler and them lived in that building on the second floor. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you're a wealth of information.
It's, you know, and so much of the change, the tremendous growth of research. You see, remember what happened after World War II, and this is important. World War II resulted in the expansion of the specialties, really. In World War II, a lot of good was accomplished with plastic surgery, for example. There weren't many plastic surgeons in the United States before World War II, I can tell you. And some of the best ones were in the Army during the war. In fact, I was a scrub nurse for one when I first went in the Army. And didn't realize at that time, you know, all the way things were. But anyway, after the war, the doctors came back and they had to get back in a different world. And so they took specialty training. And if you look at the growth of specialties in the United States, or just at Hopkins, I did some statistics recently for Dr. Hellerman, the chief of rheumatology. He had to present a paper on the changes that have occurred in house staff training in the last 50 years. And I pulled some statistics together for him, which he put together in a paper that apparently went over very well. I got a nice thank you note from him, you know, saying how that, and I saved what I sent over to him, but I don't have it in the fancy format that he used in presenting it. But it's interesting, the increase, the number of women. One of the fellows told me the other day, he said, you could count the women in medicine when I came. One or two at a time, maybe, you know. Now, he told me that, he said, I think he told me that about half of the new house officers, the new interns, are females in medicine, which is unusual. In the old days, most of the women went into medicine, went into pediatrics, OBGYN, and then some of them, dermatology, and some of the specialties where they could have a family life and not, where in medicine and surgery, well, surgery particularly, it's more difficult. The first woman house officer in surgery occurred while I was with the Department of Surgery. That was in the 1960s.
Who was she?
I can't think of her name right now. She only stayed a year. It was really sad because she was a terrific gal. Dr. Zeidema was very disappointed that she didn't want to stay. Her husband got into drugs up in New York, and she felt obligated to go up and see what she, to return to New York and see what she could do to help him. So, and I just lost track of her, you know. Since then, there have been a number of women. But it's in that, that the growth of the specialties has resulted in the growth also of research. The amount of money, do you realize that the Hopkins Medical School, I think, is number one in the country on the number of NIH grants received. So the amount of research over there, the research space, when you think of the amount of space that was there when I came and what's there now, it's unreal.
And you've watched all of it.
Yeah, and it just, you
know.
Now,
as an administrator, how involved were you in planning the buildings and deciding how space was going to be used?
Okay, on the patient facilities, when I was still working, I was actively involved. In fact, when we built the first intensive care units on the seventh floors of the Halsted and Oster buildings, and they're still up there, by the way. When we built those, we went up to New York and looked at different things. We went to Boston and looked at different things that had been done. Some of the doctors and I, the doctors that were involved. In fact, Dr. Freesinger, who's at Vanderbilt, and he is a trustee, too, of the university. Bud Freesinger, he'd be a good one to talk to.
What's his name?
Freesinger. Freesinger. Mm-hmm. I can't think of his first name, Bud. We always called him Bud Freesinger. He is a trustee of the university, too. And he trained at Hopkins in medicine and in cardiology. He knows the institutions very well, you know. I worked with him, and I have a great deal of respect for him. And the operating rooms, Dr. Blaylock, I was used all the time. I worked right with the contractors. When I came, they were still when I say the old operating rooms, they weren't the original operating rooms. Those had been torn down to build the Blaylock building. But the operating rooms that were in use were built in 1926 when the Carnegie building opened. And they weren't even air conditioned. Yeah.
You're kidding.
Well, there was no air conditioning then.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And Dr. Blaylock did some fundraising. And, in fact, a lot of the money came from a city service oil tycoon. I guess he's really from, where are they from, Georgia, from Texas? Anyway, Dr. Blaylock got a few million together for us to renovate the operating rooms, and we did it, you know, space by space by space. When I arrived, they had redone two rooms where Dr. Blaylock operated and did the Blue Babies. They were air-conditioned, and they were just finishing what became rooms number one and two. Three and four had already been finished. And from there on, down all through into the Blaylock building, I worked with the contractors to renovate to complete that space. So the space in the Blaylock building was just a big open space. I mean, the Blaylock building was built, but they didn't complete the seventh floor. They waited until they were coming through renovating the Carnegie space and then going on in and building in the Blaylock building. And I was involved in all the planning and then did studies and everything. And Dr. Blaylock, I'll never forget, he would tell me, Dr. So-and-so thinks he needs so much space. And I said, Dr. Blaylock, can I make a suggestion? I said, why don't we ask each chief, the chief of plastics, OTO, orthopedics, neuro, and so on, what he thinks he needs in the way of space. And then if you add it together, I think you'll find out that we'll have to build two more buildings. And I said, there's no way, you know, that. But they all have these big ideas. Then if you make them turn it in, then when you see what you've got, then it's easy to cut back, you know, to take it. But if you just say no without any evidence to support what you're saying, then you have a problem. And it worked very well. And since I left surgery, they have added, well, when they built the Meyer building, they built more operating rooms. They built operating rooms on the second floor of the Nelson building. They're building operating rooms in the new oncology center that's going to open. See, there are surgical procedures. And the other thing, of course, that's happened is that a lot of surgical procedures are done on an outpatient basis. When I was a student nurse, a patient that had their cataracts done, we immobilized their head with sandbags for 10 days. Yeah. Now, when I had my cataracts done, I went in the morning, I had the cataract surgery, they patched my eye, I went home that afternoon, and then the next morning I went in, they took the patch off, and I was off.
Quite a transformation.
See, is it, all these changes have changed medicine. And so when people say, oh, the old days, I don't ever want anybody to talk to me about the old days, you know, that's all right. We did the best we could with what we had in the way of knowledge, in the way of money. Remember, there wasn't all the money available. And when I took over the Marburg building, what we were charging for a private room, $26 a day was the most expensive room I had, and it wasn't paying our cost. And they had increased them from, I don't know, like $10 a day, not too long before I came. And we had a lot of patients that paid nothing. Dr. Nelson got with the state of Maryland to get them to support. This is before medical assistance, before that, to get them to pay some money to Hopkins Hospital. We were taking care of more indigent patients than the University of Maryland, which was state supported, than the Baltimore City Hospital, which was city supported.
How did he do that? How did he convince them?
Well, he convinced them. He must have done a good job.
Twisted some arms?
Well, I mean, the facts were there, you know, and it was difficult. And if we had pulled out, they'd have been, you know. Because the endowment funds didn't begin to support all the free care that we were giving.
I got to get back into these air-conditioned operating rooms.
Oh, yeah. The patient rooms weren't. The patient rooms were in air conditioned when I came.
On a day like today, It's 100 degrees outside. Yeah. Could they perform surgery?
Mm-hmm.
How did they do it?
They managed.
It's just boggles my mind.
Fans, you know, and everything. They were just.
How did they keep it sanitary?
Well.
Blowing the air around like that. Oh, it just boggles my mind to think about it.
But they did. And the patient rooms. And when I came, the hospital was on direct current. Not AC current, DC current. Okay? And when we converted from DC to AC, that we had, what a tremendous job that was. We worked seven straight days without doing it, you know, just with the conversions, because motors had to be changed and everything else. Now, but in those days, we didn't have air-conditioned patient rooms. We had window air conditioners in some rooms where there was some power to run them. But when and after we got the AC brought up into all the panels, when we had sick patients, I'd call the engineers and I'd say, we need an window air conditioner in room so-and-so. Those guys would run cables down the corridor from the big panels where the power came in and put in a window air conditioner. When you had a patient whose life, you know, was really at stake because of the heat.
There must be a lot of people walking around who have you to thank.
Well, not just me, everybody else that did it, you know. But the guys at Hopkins, I'll tell you, to this day, I had a problem recently and I asked one of the engineers, I said, how are we can't get anybody to help us get this stuff from the hospital back to the archives. Oh, Miss Cab. And he told me what to do and they took us, they had one of the engineering cars pick us up and take us back to the archives. And that's why the archives say, if you're nice to people, they never forget, you know. And one thing I always pointed out to administrators, and I feel very strongly about it, you've got to know not just the brass that are probably going to be telling you what to do or what they want. You've got to know the people that get it done. That's terribly important.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
I mean that if you really want something to be done right, you have to relate to the people that get the work done. And they have to understand and feel part of what's going to happen. And when you tell those engineers, for example, that here we got this patient, this is what's wrong, I always explain to him, without cooling, his life is really at stake. And you make them feel part of everything, why they're there. The people, you know, everybody contributes to the success of that institution, not just the MDs.
What kind of people? Tell me others.
Now everybody thinks of the big Hopkins doctors. Who else?
Well, I think you can go right down the line. The guys the people that have done things there, whether it's the electrician downstairs or whether it's one of the nurses, there's some outstanding nurses, of course. And I'm sure if you ask the doctors, they've got their favorites, you know, that do things. And the cardiac unit. When I had my coronary artery reamed out, I was very pleased to know that the young nurse that was watching the scope as to what was happening to my blood pressure and everything else, that she knew what she was doing, could adjust things and take care of me. And I can tell you that Bill Baumgartner, the head of cardiac surgery, is very pleased with the staff that he has in the operating rooms and in the cardiac units. And of course, now you see cardiology and cardiac surgery. This is one of the things I think that's great, is they're working closely together and share certain facilities. Because they are a team, you know. One can't do without the other. And very important parts of that team are the nurses that are in it. And, for example, John Cameron has, the chief of surgery, has the best record in the United States, probably the world, on pancreatic cancer, the corrective procedures that he's done, his success rate far exceeds anybody else's. And one of the key people on his staff is a nurse, and he'd be the first one to tell you that, and what she can do in the follow-up and the care of those patients, you know. She doesn't work on a unit, she's assigned to him full-time.
And what's her name?
Oh, I can't think of it right now,
okay.
But, you know,
find out.
Yeah, but you're going to want to talk to John anyway. Mm-hmm. John, I think he had his 60th birthday, so he was here at medical school and then trained here, and so he's been around, John must have finished medical school, let's see, around 1960, I think, or so. He's been around for a while. Yeah. Have you decided what people mm-hmm. you're going to speak? And, okay.
You've mentioned, and you were way at the mm-hmm. top of a lot of lists, I got. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Cameron being the top in his field.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that Hopkins has a worldwide reputation mm-hmm. for. how does that kind of excellence evolve? And tell me what you've observed through the years.
I think that kind of excellence depends on a couple of things. One, it depend. You can't be outstanding unless you have a darn good staff to support you. I don't care who you are. Maybe if you're an Einstein and you're just doing thinking, that's one thing. But if you're a surgeon and you've got an idea that this might work, you need in that research lab quality people who are going to be to try to do things the way it should be done, and that you can depend upon them to being exacting. And when you go in that operating room, you're dependent upon the people that know what they're doing, and if something's wrong, can bring it to your attention. That, you know, in other words, the quality of the supporting staff is absolutely essential to becoming the best. Without that, there's no way. And I think that Hopkins has exceeded. That's one of the things that's made it great. Not that they haven't had terribly bright people come. I mean, and I think fortunately the first people that came, Welsh, Osler, Halstead, Kelly, these were people who came to Hopkins for one reason. It was an opportunity to do something different, to bring into being a lot of different things. And, you know, a lot of time was spent looking around the world, looking at Europe basically in those days, as to what kind of a hospital they wanted, how it would design and everything like that, you know. Like Billings, of course, he designed the New York Public Library, you know. He was the Billings Administration Building is named for him. He was the Civil War doctor who participated in that. But and of course, the trustees, too, were exacting, the original trustees. It took a long time to build a hospital because they never touched the endowment. They could only expend the income on the endowment. So it took, instead of building it in a few years, it took about 10 years to build it. Which is interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, and then they did things like when they built the Phipps Building for psychiatry. That was the first inpatient unit for psychiatric patients associated with a general hospital.
Really? Yeah. And when was that about?
That opened in 1913, I think it was. I think the first patient was 1913. Yeah.
Well, that was very forward thinking, wasn't mm-hmm. it?
Mm-hmm. There were some important people that had become psychiatric patients. Meyer came down, he was from New York. He was head of the New York State Lunacy Commission. That's what it was called. The first director of the American Mental Hygiene Society, one of the problems with age, I'm going to be 80 in January, you know, is recalling names. I'll think of it after you leave or something. But anyway, he himself was a manic depressive. He was a Yale student. He was in and out of, there's a book called The Mind That Found Itself, and it's worth reading sometime. It has nothing to do with Hopkins, but it's a very interesting book. And right now I just can't think of his name. But he became the first head of the American Mental Hygiene Society, and he himself had been a manic depressive, in and out of insane asylums, as they were called in those days. Yeah. Still the argument goes on as to how many psychiatric hospitals we need and whether patients should be in hospitals or whether they should be in... The idea was to have them in little cottages, you know, with group living and so on. It doesn't work unless you can get the people to staff them, and that's been the problem, you know. It's one thing to work 8 hours a day with the psychiatric patients 5 days a week or 6 days a week, but it's another thing to live with them around the clock, too. I think it's hard to get people to accept those positions. Good people, the kind of people you want, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people on the street, I'm sure, need, you know, psychiatric care.
Looks that
yeah,
way.
Yeah. But I think the again, if you just look at psychiatry and the changes that have occurred in the care of mental patients, mental illness, a lot of it stems from the drugs being that are available. The care, on the other hand, some procedures, for example, shock therapy, in certain instances is still used. However, they have perfected the technique of giving shock so that you don't have the damage that used to occur in the old days. Paul McHugh is an interesting person to talk to, too. He's a professor of psychiatry.
Tell me about him.
He came here from the Oregon Health Science University, but he's originally from Boston. He's a very interesting individual. He's trained in the old school, a follower of the old school of the biological basis of mental illness. He doesn't believe in the group that call themselves, my friend is one. I have a friend here. We came up, she's from the University of Virginia too. The Freudian concept, you know, the Freud approach to psychiatry. He's not a Freudian follower. He's a Meyer. Meyer, by the way, they believe in neurology and being very important with psychiatry and the neurological basis for certain illnesses, of course. Rather than the Freudian approach to the treatment of psychiatric patients. He's an interesting individual. He's very blunt and will tell you what he thinks about some things, too. I think that they have brought in some chiefs of service that were not very popular and didn't survive. In other words, they've not been without mistakes in selection. The buildings. Certain chiefs could come in and probably get, well, I'll tell you, the guys that were smart before they would accept a job would say, I want this, this, and this, you know. I'm sure a lot of that went on. That was one way to, you know, if somebody retired, although getting to be the chief of surgery or the chief of medicine at Hopkins is certainly one of the top, those are top positions in the medical schools in the United States. Mm-hmm. What kind of a person should be the dean of the medical school? I don't know. They're interesting. If you look at the deans of the medical school, Chesney had stepped down when I came. Bard was the dean. And he was just taking over as the dean. And he was a wonderful person. Since Bard stepped down, Turner, I guess, took over after Bard. And he's now, what, 95 or 96?
97.
And, you know, and really pretty sharp. He has the same problem I have to do. I'll turn around somebody and say to somebody, I can't remember the name. What was the name, you know? Guy McCann says it's not you can't remember, Cavi, it just takes longer to recall. But brain overload, we blame it on. And then there was a dean in there that did not survive. Isn't that terrible? I can't think of his name. And Dr. Morgan took over for a short while after that.
When you say someone didn't survive, what do you mean?
They sort of eased him out. There's a way of doing that.
Is it a top secret or?
Well, you know, I mean, they see that they make it important. Well, in some other position becomes available that, and I'm sure that he knows what's an unwritten, but that one dean in between, how I could forget his name, that's terrible. I should have brought a book along with me so I could remember that he's here. He is dead now, but I think that there was one president of the university that didn't last very long. Did you pick that up when you were there?
You're talking about Lincoln Gordon?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, Milton Eisenhower came back and things snapped out then. Terrible. He came from Vanderbilt to us, and why I can't think of his name right now, I don't know. But there was one dean of the medical school that.
What's your sense of that relationship to Homewood, between Homewood and East Baltimore?
Oh, well, I know that a few years back there was a little animosity on the part of the medical people when they were asked to bail out the university with some of its financial problems. And because the university professor, the Homewood people don't put in the hours that the men do around on the medical campus. And so they bring in a lot more income on the medical campus, is true, you know. But there were a few years back, and I don't remember what year it was actually, but it was a few years back, there was a special, the medical school had to pay extra in to the university. They were having financial problems. And there was animosity. Animosity is not the right word. There was ill, they were, a lot of them were mad about it, you know. When you work the hours that those people do on the medical campus, they're not in the 40-hour week. And particularly the people that are bringing in the money. And then you go over in the Homewood campus and you try to get somebody on the phone. Well, he isn't in the office today. You know, he's at home doing something. He was working on his book or doing something, you know. They don't teach that many hours over there. And on the medical campus, you realize they have to give a certain number of hours to teaching. And in fact, right now, some of the part-timers, they all want to say they're on the staff of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, but they're not contributing much. And so I saw recently where there's some discussion going on about if somebody wants to keep their Hopkins appointment, you know, what they have to contribute in the way toward teaching. That's been written up recently. So I think that, but a lot of care, there are committees that select new chairman of departments. And I think a great deal of thought goes into, you know, what to do. How's your water, by the way? You need
some.
I'm fine.
I'm fine. Thanks.
I think that the members of the committees to select a department chairman really give very serious thought to, you know, how the department fits into the school, where things are going, and what kind of a person do they really want. Because you have to be more than a good surgeon to run surgery. You have to be a good administrator. You've got a big department. Departments of medicine and surgery are the two huge departments. Of course, surgery is now called a section of surgical sciences, and under it are the departments of neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, a number of, let's see, they have orthopedics, neuro, otolaryngology, general surgery. There's another one, neuro, orthopedics, plastic surgery, pediatric surgery.
I'm going to have to switch tapes, but before we do, you just said a word I haven't the faintest idea how to spell.
Otolaryngology, O-T-O-L-A-R-Y, only it's now called otorhinolaryngology.
Go for it. Spell it for me.
Yeah, O-T-O, otolaryngology, L-A-R-Y-N-G-O-L-O-G-Y. The department, I think, is called it was just otolaryngology in the old days. Now it's otolaryngology and head and neck surgery. Head and neck surgery is part of that title now.
Well, thank you. My transcriber will be very pleased to have that spelled out. Yeah. Can I switch tapes and pop in another one?